This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform for creating a blog, a website, a portfolio, or an online store. Create your own space today by visiting squarespace.com and use offer code TREK10 to save 10%. Plus, if you'd like to support our programming personally, visit trek.fm/donate to get our alien badges and art prints featuring original illustration by Tobu Ushi.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 114, A Statue People. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Matthew Rushing. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including the Enterprise Season 3 Blu-ray trailer and cover art, as well as how to get your pet ready for Starfleet duty. Plus, we'll preview two tracks from 5-Year Mission's upcoming album Year 3, and tell you how you can help the band. We'll also debate whether Spock or Data is the most human character in Star Trek. Then in the feature, we're joined by Kate Walsh to discuss the Enterprise episode, Home. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Matthew. It's great to have you back on the Ready Room. You know, I don't know if you realize, but because we do other shows together, it's been quite a while since you've been on the Ready Room.
You know, Chris, it has. It just hasn't been working out recently for me to be available, so I was glad to be able to do this, and we're going to get to talk some Enterprise, which you know I love. I'm a huge Enterprise fan, and we'll get to talk one of my favorite episodes as well. And so, and in fact, I mean, what's really awesome is our first story is Enterprise. I mean, so I'm just getting, you know, this is just best week ever.
Really, it is. Yes, we're kicking off our Enterprise Week show with a story about Enterprise. And I've been waiting for this, Matthew, because, you know, the Next Generation Blu-ray releases, we get them fairly on a regular schedule. You know, we kind of know it's going to be a couple of months and then the next one's going to come out. And,
yeah.
You know, we have Enterprise 1 Blu-rays, we have Enterprise Season 2 Blu-rays, and we've been waiting, like, when is Season 3 going to come? And the answer is, we still don't know. It's coming soon. but the trailer has been released by CBS for Season 3. And it's actually a really great trailer.
It really is. I mean, this trailer, I think, you know, Chris, we were talking about just a second ago on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
That this trailer really makes you want to see this season if you've never seen it. And it brings out all the most exciting parts of the season to help really sell this. And, you know, I mean, honestly, there is so much action in Season 3. You don't have to work hard to pull together a pretty awesome trailer. And, you know, at this point, the CGI was getting better as well. There's some pretty spectacular scenes in Season 3, you know, with the Enterprise being destroyed and, you know, especially in Twilight and those kind of things. And so you get some great stuff in here, and all of that is packed together into a fantastic trailer that makes me really want this season. I just wish that, you know how the TNG seasons will go down to 50-something?
Yeah.
Well, the Enterprise seasons are not doing that, unfortunately. Season 2 is still around $70-something, and I still haven't got it because of that, because I just don't have... You know, that's a lot of money right now for me. So
at some point it'll come down. And, you know, with the holiday season coming up, if you hang in there, it wouldn't surprise me if sometime in November or December, they drop lots and lots of different television shows down in price for the holidays. So maybe you'll be able to pick it up then. I personally went ahead and just pre-ordered Season 3 last night, because when I went to check the pricing to set up the story for today, I saw that the pre-order price was $76.99, and like you said, the Enterprise set prices haven't really been dropping below the 70 range to start with, but they often are up around 99 or 100 something. So I thought that, you know, it's probably until the day before release, it's probably not going to go down. Now, the day before release, it'll probably go to like 62 or, you know, 56 or something like that, just for a very short time, but I went ahead and locked it in. But going back to the trailer itself here, I think this trailer is going to make people who have never watched Enterprise before go, wow, that looks like a really cool story. I'm going to have to go pick this up and watch this, or at least go on Netflix and watch it, you know, in the current version that's there, because it feels like a movie, doesn't it? It feels like this is the trailer for one movie that you would go to the theater and see.
Yeah, Chris, I think that was one of the things, you know, whether you loved or you didn't love season three of Enterprise, one of the best parts about it is you can sit down, and it's a lot like 24, where you want to watch every single episode in sequence as quick as possible.
As quick as possible, yeah.
You want to keep watching the story, and yeah. They do a really good job of keeping you. It's like a great book where you just want to keep flipping the page, and you'll go, okay, one more chapter. In fact, mm-hmm. There's a whole Portlandia skit about that, where the two people sit down to watch Battlestar Galactica one night. So say we all! And like 5 weeks later, they have gone to work and they're sitting on their couch and they finished this show and they're like, wait, that's it?
Four seasons, they're right through.
Man, when's the last time you took a shower? I don't know, but you smell. Yeah. So that's what, you know, this season of Enterprise is going to be like for people, especially if they've never seen it. They're going to start that episode one and they're just going to want to keep going because it really yeah. is that kind of season. And because you want to see the resolution.
Right.
And yeah, you're right. This trailer really gives that sense of urgency to the story.
It feels like one story. Right, like this is a movie I'm going to go see. You know, when the Zindi arc was on in first run, I wasn't a huge fan of it. And I think that more than any other part of Star Trek, it benefits from DVDs, Blu-rays, Netflix, because anyone who tells me now that they don't like the Zindi arc and that that's the worst season of Star Trek and it just, you know, it's just a ratings gimmick. And in a way, I mean, it was an attempt to capture more ratings. There, you can't argue that it wasn't. However, it is a story that, you know, I tell people, go sit down and just watch it as quickly as you can. Watch four episodes a day. Just watch it over the course of a week.
Yeah.
And you'll find that it's actually a quite interesting story. But when you watch it once a week, like when it was in first run, it's sort of hard. It feels kind of mm-hmm. like it's not cohesive. Yeah.
You know, Chris, and it's funny that you mentioned that. I was actually thinking about that with the novels because I just finished David R. George III's recent book, The Beginning of the Fall, Revelations and Dust. And I was thinking to myself, you know, these books, they come out over, you know, span of 2 or 3 years, these huge long storylines that I'm like, man, I just wish they would come out every month, you know, because it would be so much easier for me to keep track of everything that's happened instead of me. I mean, in the book, he's referencing things that happened, you know, 2, 3, 4 years ago in the literary world. And I'm trying to rack my brain, trying to remember everything that's happened. And so the same way that we enjoy consuming TV, where it's better if it happens at least every week, or you get to watch an entire season and see it play out, you know, within a span of a couple of weeks on Netflix, there is something to be said for being able to watch a show consecutively to really mm-hmm. see how the themes build. Yeah. In the same way that you might sit down and over maybe a week and read a book and see the whole thing play out. And yeah, I'm glad the season's coming out. It is a really good season of Enterprise, and I think it's going to look great on the our HD screens. So.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. You know, that's how we watch every show these days. We don't even have regular cable anymore. We have Netflix and Hulu, and we just watch shows by just going straight through a series. I think that's the way of the future. While we're on the topic here, I did want to get your thoughts, Matthew, on the cover art, because the first two season sets have been beautiful, especially, you know, photographs don't do them justice. You have to actually hold the box in your hand because of the way that they're printing it. It has sort of a holographic type effect when the light hits it. It's really nice. Now, the season three cover, this is what I thought when I first saw it, and this is what people are posting on TrekCore and other places that have shown the cover. really, really weird choice. Now, it's not that the image itself is bad. They've done some Photoshop work on it to move people around a little bit, and they've replaced T'Pol from the original image with another image of T'Pol. But the big problem is that it's a Season 1 photo. Why are you putting a Season 1 photo on the Season 3 box set when there is a beautiful promotional shot of the cast from Season 3 out there?
I don't understand this either, Chris. It is disappointing that they wouldn't use that Season 3 photo because a lot changed in Season 3, the look of the characters, especially T'Pol. I mean, she's no longer in that uniform anymore.
And Archer doesn't have the part of Steel anymore.
Exactly. He has a much more, go get 'em haircut, Archer stopped buttoning the buttons all the way to the top, which kind of gave him that more rebellious, desperate captain look, which was really important in the season. Everything about that, I feel that they've done, it's not bad artwork, you said. It is, they photoshopped it nicely. It does look very good, but it doesn't fit season three. And that kind of, we had that wonderful trailer and the urgency there. This box does nothing to give you that urgency that season three has. Whereas if you had manipulated that photo that they had used for promotion for season three and put that on the cover, I think you would have much better served.
Right. Now, the photo that we're talking about it's one with the crew on the bridge. The bridge looks beautiful. It has very nice blue lighting behind it. All the characters look great. You would have to Photoshop it to move the characters a bit closer together. You probably need to move Travis in. You need to move Phlox in. But you could do it. I could do it myself. CBS has to have designers who could do it and make it look seamless. They've already done it with this photo that they're using on the current box artwork, which is the photo that was in Entertainment Weekly in the September 7th, 2001 issue. But they replaced Jolene Blaylock with another photo of her from later on in season one. So she still has that haircut. Was that the Mo Curly Larry haircut from season one? So I don't know.
The Three Stooges look.
The Three Stooges look, yeah. I it wouldn't surprise me to see this cover be completely redone before the season is released, because we don't know when it's going to come out. I suspect that it's not going to be out until the beginning of 2014. That's just the feeling that I have, because they don't seem to even know what the extras are yet, because they don't even mention what the extras are on the Blu-ray. We just see clips of Connor and Linda sitting in that auditorium, which we've seen on the previous season sets, talking about season three, and that's it. So it wouldn't surprise me if they listen to, because you remember they redid the original season one covers as well after fans said,
that's really not very good.
But it also wouldn't surprise me if they just stick with this because, they're the studio and they've decided this is what they're going to go with. So we'll see. But at any rate, I think everyone is going to want to pick this up because it really looks great. And they took a good approach to the trailer. They didn't try to make it corny or anything like that. So very, very nice.
Yeah, well done. I'm glad that they are really seeming to push Enterprise too. The fact that they're giving us this trailer, they're wanting people to buy Enterprise. And I know that the extras on season two were fantastic, having the big cast retrospective
really
together
yes.
with Brannon, which I really can't wait to get. I want the season. It's not that I won't buy it, because I really do want that extra, and I'm willing to go ahead and pay for it sometime when I can get it. When it's affordable, I just had to go to the eye doctor and that's a few hundred dollars there. So, there's only so much to go around unless Chris, you got a money tree in your backyard?
I wish I did. I sure wish I did. So, Matthew, at the beginning of this trailer, what we see is the shuttle pod landing and we see Porthos jumping out and running across the planet, which is from the episode Strange New World at the beginning of season one. What is missing from the trailer is something that we could get in this next story, which is a company called A Crowded Coop. And what it is pet paraphernalia with a Star Trek theme. So you can enroll your pets in Starfleet pretty much. Do you have a pet, Matthew?
Chris, I don't. At the rent house that I have, we're not allowed to have pets. Oh, and so, but, you know, my mom does, my brother-in-law and sister do. They have smaller dogs that, you know, these kind of things would, you know, what is it with people and small dogs and like wanting to put them in things like sweaters? Right. And so you could get, you know, I could get one of these for my mom's dog and, you know, put it in a Starfleet uniform and all that kind of stuff. This is when you know that you're really a Trekkie. Like, you live, eat, and breathe this stuff is when your dog starts wearing the uniform and it's got a Starfleet collar. It has a Starfleet plush toy to, you know, like plush Klingon to rib up, you know. It has a nice pillow bed with a Starfleet insignia on it. I mean, this is when you know you may have jumped the shark as a fan.
Or you jump the targ.
Exactly. You've the Saylot.
You've jumped the Saylot. That's perfect. Yeah, I see a lot here in Japan. I mean, people here, I know it's the same in the States as well, but people here spend a lot of money on merchandise for their pets. And you see a lot of dogs walking around with sweaters on and all kinds of stuff. If I were a dog, I would be really nervous if my owner came home, though, with a Starfleet uniform for me to wear and it was red. You know, putting a red shirt on me, then take me out for a walk, especially if I'm a small dog and, you know, there are big dogs in the neighborhood. I'd be nervous.
You know what? That is a good point. I hadn't thought about it until I realized where you were going with that. And, oh, man, I feel sorry for any dogs who get put red shirt. Whew. Goodness, yeah, I hope they come home. Lassie, come home.
That's right. Lassie would be that one red shirt. It'd be like Scotty with his engineering shirt.
Exactly.
He'd be the one red shirt who always comes home.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
So there are some quotes here from Mary Olson and Brandy Tanner of A Crowded Coop. They're the co-founders. Mary Olson says, "We are Star Trek, the original series fans first and foremost, and we are very excited to bring other fans authentic gear for their pets." So one thing to remember here is that Mary and Brandy, their dogs, they were the guinea pigs, or the tribbles, I suppose, if you will, for this whole concept. You know, before Mary and Brandy went, they got funding for the company and everything, their pets had to walk around dressed as Starfleet officers. And they were the only ones.
I wonder how many times they had to be brought back with special magic con blood from failed experiments.
It's possible. At least fashion disasters may have taken place.
Exactly.
Does con's blood help you to recover from fashion disasters?
I don't know. That's a great question. I wonder at the bottom of their website if they say no fan dogs were hurt during the, you know, the testing of these materials or uniforms or.
Well, you know, in Into Darkness, we did see everyone in those scuba suits. Kirk was wearing one. He did come back to life at the end of the movie. So maybe Khan's blood will help you recover from a fashion disaster.
That is true. You know, everybody was wearing those scuba suits. They all looked equally kind of bad. So, you know, it wasn't just Kirk. I mean, Sulu wasn't looking awesome in his either. No. So
Uhura looked okay in hers, though.
Well, it is Uhura, you know, and she does look fantastic in just about anything, so.
So Brandy Tanner added here, "What a wonderful way to bring one of the most enduring pop culture brands to your four-legged friends." Now, I mean, come on, it's Star Trek. Are we going to assume that everyone has four legs? All of our pets have four legs. You know, A-Rex had three. What if A-Rex, do you think dogs on A-Rex's world, do they have three legs as well? Would they be able to fit into this stuff?
Ooh, that's a good question. I don't really know if you would be able to do that. I mean, can you get a three? I mean, we have three-legged dogs here on Earth. You know, I don't know if...
But they're not designed like a tripod, though, like A-Rex, so...
That's a good... Yeah, I don't... That's true. How do you get A-Rex? And I don't know how you do that, Chris.
But you know, this raises another question here now that I think about it. A-Rex had three legs and three arms. So would that mean that dogs on his world would have six legs?
Ooh, or seven. I think they might have seven.
What's
yeah.
the seventh
it's leg? It's a seven-legged... I don't know. What's that third arm for?
In place of a tail.
Exactly. There you go. There's an extra hand on the back there, so they can kind of like sit up. Which, strangely enough, you know, they can use a few of those legs, kind of prop them up, and then they have that back leg to really prop themselves up and stand upright. That's yeah, what it's for.
I guess so. All right. Well, this story just caught my eye as being, like you said, this is maybe when, as a fan, maybe you've jumped the Targ or jumped the Saylite if you dress your pants up like this. But I don't know, you know. The dog collars are kind of tasteful. I could see putting a dog collar on. My pet.
The dog collar, I mean, yeah, that's just normal.
That's normal, so. Yeah. So we'll put a link in the show notes to this if you want to go check it out over on StarTrek.com. They have some pictures and more information. Okay, Matthew, we had a few weeks ago on the show, we had our friend Mike Rittenhouse on during the feature. And of course, Mike is a member of the great Star Trek tribute band, 5-Year Mission. They are writing songs for every episode of the original series, and year one was fantastic, year two was fantastic. We've been waiting quite a while for year three. I know I certainly have been waiting for this album to come out. It's almost done now. They're ready, almost ready to press the albums and get those CDs out to everyone, and they have launched a Kickstarter campaign to help fund this.
Yeah, Chris, I was watching the video that they put on the Kickstarter and just how they were having trouble with, you know, finally getting this printed, and realized, obviously, you know, Kickstarter is a great way to be able to have fans basically just pay for what they want. And I loved seeing the fact that 5-Year Mission was able to reach their minimum goal so quickly.
Very quickly.
They have already reached the 1500 mark, which they needed to get the album printed. And now they're really just looking for some great stretch goals that they have. And I think as fans, if you love 5-Year Mission, this is so easy to do. They have a lot of great incentives for signing up, from $1 all the way to $1,000. So if they get up to $3,000, they're going to be able to reprint year one, which has been out of print. And so if you have missed this and you wanted to get their album again, you help this Kickstarter out, you get them $3,000, and man, you can have your own copy of year one, as well as, you know, you get them to $4,500, Chris, and they'll be able to professionally master year three. And with all the different incentives that they have, I don't know why you wouldn't want to help these guys out. They do great work. It's hilarious. In fact, Chris, you sent me a couple of their songs, their demos for year three on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
And really, really was enjoying the I, Mud one. It's just so cheeky and funny. I really enjoyed it.
It is great. Well, why don't we play a clip of that one real quick for everybody? That is a great one. I'm looking forward to getting that on the album. And also, Mike sent me one more, and this track is for the Doomsday Machine. So let's play a clip of that as well.
Like the beginning of this one, Chris. It's really funny talking about Matt Decker and him being lost and being a little bit crazy. And this is a good song. Both of these songs, Chris, I think it shows, you know, I mean, anybody who's heard their songs before just knows that they do great work. And let's help these guys put out the best album they can in year three and get them to that professional mastering level.
And I think what these two tracks demonstrate is the diversity in the sound. You said earlier that it's hilarious. Some of these songs are very, very funny. Mm-hmm. Some of their songs are very, very serious as well. So, you know, they're not a parody band. They take a different approach to different episodes, depending on the tone of the episode. And they all write songs. So we have Noah, Andy, Patrick, Mike, and Chris. And they're all musicians, and they all write these songs. And by divvying up who's going to write a song for a particular episode, you get a lot of musical diversity on the albums. And it's really fun, you know, to hear their take on the stories and what they pick out of it. You know, some of them write very literal songs about the episodes, and some of them write very abstract episodes from the episodes. You know, I was playing Year Two in the car a lot when it first came out. And unfortunately, now my children will say, "I'm going to kick his ass," which is Mike's song about the episode Arena, about Kirk is going to kick the guard's ass. So
that's I have to be awesome. A little bit
careful about that.
So might not be kid appropriate all the time, Warp 5. So
most of them
careful.
Are. Most of them are, yeah. But yeah, there's that one. So you know, go check it out. The songs that are going to be on your three are The Changeling, Mirror Mirror, The Apple, The Doomsday Machine, Cat's Paw, I, Mud, Metamorphosis, Journey to Babel, Friday's Child, The Deadly Years, Obsession, Wolf in the Fold, The Trouble with Tribbles, The Gamesters of Triskelion, A Piece of the Action, and The Immunity Syndrome. And they have, I believe there were 21 different levels of incentives that they have for you to donate. And as Matthew said, they range from $1 up to $1,000. If you go all the way up to $1,000, they have a couple of interesting incentives. One of them is that they will play your private party. So they'll come and play at your party. It is limited to a reasonable geographic area for the band. And that includes Illinois, Ohio, Kentucky, or Michigan. Now, they may come to other locations, but you'll need to discuss that with them first and, you know, figure out the arrangements. And the other one, and I like this one, Matthew, you know, they do these EPs. They've had the Tribbles EP, for example, and they're going to do a Spock's Brain one. And they will actually write a song on a topic of your choice if you contribute $1,000 or more. What topic would you want them to write a song about? Remember, it needs to be a TOS topic.
You know, Chris, I was thinking this through, and I feel like we need a lot of Roberta Lincoln songs. So I need a whole song about Roberta Lincoln and her fashion choices.
Oh, that is a fantastic idea, actually. They need to get on that. I like that.
I mean, I feel like that would be a groovy, hippin' tune.
It really would. Maybe she'll have the flower child stuff that she had from the comics
exactly.
that we reviewed on Literary Treks
exactly.
recently. All right. So everyone, please go over and support 5-Year Mission. We love these guys. You can go to Kickstarter. We'll put a link in the show notes. You can also go to their website at 5yearmission.net, not .com, but .net, and check stuff out there as well. They have 27 days to go. They very quickly, in I think it was only like 2 days, they reached their minimum $1,500 goal. Currently, as we're recording this, they have 44 backers for a total of $1,656. And those stretch goals are really important. Not only that, but just supporting the band. You know, all these guys, they have their normal day jobs. They do this out of their love for Star Trek. It's very expensive to do this kind of work, and especially to produce the albums. And go and help them out and check out all the great goals that they have. You know, a lot of the goals in the $40, $50, $75 range get you signed copies of the albums as well as other merchandise, you know, t-shirts, get your name sung in a song and so forth. A lot of fun stuff there. So go check that out and support 5-Year Mission. Matthew, one more thing to talk about in news today. We've done this the past few weeks. We've been talking about these StarTrek.com polls. I've just found some of them interesting recently. And this one in particular, I wanted to talk about because I knew you were going to be co-hosting with me. And I think it's a great topic to get your thoughts on. It's the kind of stuff we talk about a lot on The Orb. You know, we talk about the characters so much. And this poll asked, the Trek character who was the most human is. And 30,000 people voted. They were given 6 pre-selected options. And those options were Data, Spock, Neelix, Quark, Worf, and Odo. And who did these voters choose as the character from Star Trek, who was not human, of course, who was the most human?
Well, they chose Data at 29%, which I thought was interesting. Spock was next with 25%. And then you had Neelix, Quark, Worf, and Odo as the rounding out there at the very end. I don't know. What do you think about that, Chris, having Data chosen as number one?
Yeah, that's a good question. I also found interesting here that Spock got 25% and Neelix got 21%. So Neelix was just nipping on the heels of Spock, and that I found kind of unusual. I think that having Data and Spock at the top of the poll, that feels right to me. You know, they are the two characters who were really searching for what it means to be human. But I don't know. I think I would probably personally, from these choices, put Spock first on my list.
You know, Chris, I was thinking that same thing. If I were to do this list, I would definitely have voted for Spock. And I think it's because, I like Data, but unlike a lot of people, I didn't respond to him as well, I think, as others did. He's an okay character. I unfortunately think he overshadowed people who that could have been more interesting, actually, because I'd actually seen this story play out before with Spock. And in a lot of ways, I kind of just wanted something different. And they just, a lot of times, especially in the films, just gave us a replay of a lot of things they had done.
Well,
with Spock.
It's because he was such a fan favorite. You know, they ended up focusing on him so much. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so it makes sense to see him at the top of the list. I'm not surprised at all. I would have definitely voted for Spock, though.
So tell me, one reason, again, I wanted to talk about this is because you're really, really great at delving into characters and the depth of the characters. Tell me why you would put Spock at the top of the poll.
You know, I think the reason that I would have put Spock at the top of the poll, and a lot of the reasons I think we've talked about in some ways before, when you look at Spock at the very first episode that you see him in, and you know, which is the cage, which is very strange Spock.
Very strange.
Then you get all
Spock,
the way to when I think of him kind of at the end, which is the undiscovered country. Mm-hmm. And the conversation that we've talked about before where he has with Valeris, and about the ways that he's come to terms with what it means to be a logical Vulcan and understanding the difference between logic and wisdom, and that wisdom is logic is really the beginning of what it means to be wise, what it means to be a person that has evolved. And I think that growth there is probably one of the greatest character arcs of Star Trek we see. And it's a very long one. And
it's a long one, yeah.
And so for that reason, I think Spock really deserved to be at the top here, because then what you see play out in Data is really just a replay of that. It's just a kind of a carbon copy, honestly, kind of that.
Well, it's a carbon
copy.
Or
just the Pinocchio syndrome.
Right, yeah, right. Yeah, it's a copy, but it's a more simplistic copy as well. Because that scene with Valeris is one of my favorite scenes in Star Trek, in Spock's quarters. And the thing that he says to her after what you just quoted is he says, "You must have faith that the universe will unfold as it should." And just the idea of a Vulcan saying you must have faith instead of looking towards logic for something. And I said Data's journey is a more simplistic version of Spock's. You know, Spock, he learned what it was like to be human over time from being with Kirk and especially with Bones. But then the reset switch gets hit and he goes back to having to have his mind retrained, and he's forgotten what all that is, and he has to find it again. And what you see in the Undiscovered Country, is a character who's reaching just a monumental moment, a change for that character, that Spock can say what he says to Valeris. And I think it shows that Spock finally reached that point of being human and being able to have faith and trust and see multiple sides of a situation, analyze it. And he's just unlike any other Vulcan that we see.
Well, and I think in some ways, the fact that Spock is talking about faith in a very religious sense, almost. I mean, he's not just talking about faith as, you know, like, yeah, it's a very religious thing. And
well,
I think
the painting on the wall.
That's exactly, you know, and you know, Vulcans kind of have some kind of religion. We've seen.
Yeah. They're very spiritual. There is an ancient spirituality to them.
But the way that Spock is talking about it is much more human idea of faith and spirituality and a greater something beyond. And yeah, for him to come to that is just a huge monumental moment. Yeah. And I think, it's what makes him such a great character. And one of the reasons he was so loved by so many people, including obviously us, is a character because he helped us in some ways, I think, come to terms with our own humanity and the things that we struggle with. By watching him, we were able to kind of work through those things ourselves.
You know, I was talking to Larry yesterday, and we were talking about how it feels as time goes on, Star Trek fans, fewer and fewer Star Trek fans really know the original series, like really know it inside out and follow the characters through. I wonder if that's a little bit of it in this poll too, that the voters in the poll are people who grew up with at least TNG being their first series, if not later on. And they know Spock from the films. Maybe they are less familiar with Spock's journey from the cage all the way through to the undiscovered country. And so that might also skew it a little bit towards Data being the person who came out on top by 4%. So I did want to ask you one last thing about this. Could you think of any character outside of the six choices that were given that you feel, you know, went on a great journey and became more human over the course of their time on a series?
You know, this is really tough because, you know, the only person that I can think of that is honestly just another Spock or Data, which is Seven of Nine, but she's already human.
But she's already human, but she lost her humanity. Yeah.
Exactly. So, which made that honestly kind of an interesting thing. And how do you regain humanity when it's been completely stripped away from you? Even more so than Picard as Locutus. And so that is the only other character that jumped out at me where I thought really had that character arc that I could say became more human. You know, somebody like Kira or something like that, they already are very human. They might be Bajoran, but they already have a very human nature to them.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's hard to think of, for me, I don't know. Did you think of anybody at all?
You know, not really. I think that Seven of Nine should have been on this poll instead of Neelix.
I agree with you. I don't really think there's a reason for Neelix to be on this list because, again, his species is, and his character is already more human, than not.
And, I don't know, the choices are kind of odd to me. Like, I started to say maybe they put Neelix on here because they were trying to think of a Voyager character and they didn't think about Seven and Nine, they put Neelix, but there's no Enterprise character on here at all, and T'Pol should be on this poll.
Exactly. Yeah, T'Pol, again, another great character who definitely becomes very human by the end of the series, as we will talk about in the feature, I think, some of her human characteristics. And
yeah,
so,
I think so. So this was interesting, but yeah, I think Spock should have been there. All right. Well, Matthew, that's all we have in news this week. Before we jump into our feature where we're going to talk about Enterprise in the episode Home and T'Pol, as we just mentioned right here, let's tell everyone about our sponsor for this week's show, Squarespace. Your support of our sponsors is very important to making it possible for us to bring the Ready Room to you every week. And there's a great way that you can support us, which is just to go check out Squarespace. It's the all-in-one platform that combines hosting and content management, and it makes it simple for you to create your own space online. You know, you could create a blog if you just want to talk about a particular topic. You can create a website if you have a bigger plans or you're a business. If you're an artist, you can do a portfolio, a musician, you know, you can share your music online. They have great audio tools built into the platform as well. Or if you want to sell things, you can create an online store. We built Trek FM on Squarespace. That's what we did with it. And I use it for my other client work as well. I've been a Squarespace customer for the past 6 years. I love the platform. And apart from the simple fact that the tools are awesome, one of the things I also love is that they're constantly improving their platform. You know, they're putting new things in all the time. You can check out their blog. They'll tell you about the new features that they've added. And on top of that, I'm a designer. That's my profession. And so I really appreciate the beautiful designs that they give you to start with and how they make it so easy for you to work with those designs as a starting point to create a very unique website, whether it's for your own use or for a business. And on top of that, the amazing thing is that it starts at just $8 per month. And you can get a free custom domain registration if you sign up for that annual plan. Now, Matthew, we talk often on the shows about Squarespace and the things we love about it and what makes it unique and easy to use. What are three key points that you like about Squarespace?
Well, Chris, as you were talking about, you have the design-focused nature of Squarespace and the fact that they really do care about design. Their templates are all extremely clean and neat so that they allow your content really to be the focus of the website. And for me, one of the most important things, and it, I think is a great reference, as you see on Trek FM, you can see that cleanliness and it, just that focused nature that allows our content to just pop. The next thing that I really do love about it is just that you can connect all of those accounts that you might want to share all of this information on your site easily. So you've got your Twitter, your Facebook, your LinkedIn, your Pinterest, your Instagram, your Google, and we could go on and on because the list is endless these days of social media outlets where you want to share your content. And this Squarespace makes that simple and easy to do. You can set up the times you want it to be done. You can put everything in there to make it simple and easy. And then lastly, it's got responsive design. And as we know, Chris, from living in a world where we all do things on the mobile, you've got your phone, you've got your tablet and your computer, Squarespace has unique design so that the mobile design scales automatically to wherever you're looking at your site, which is fantastic because it really makes your site and your content pop out best by whatever medium you're looking it on. So whether it's my iPhone or my computer, the site looks fantastic.
Yeah, it just reflows to fit the screen size and orientation with you just building the site one time in the browser, which is a fantastic time saver and makes it easier on your visitors as well. And, you know, also I mentioned in the beginning that if you want to sell items, you can create a store. Squarespace has teamed up with Stripe to create a fantastic commerce feature that allows you to sell physical or digital goods on your website and process credit cards, calculate taxes, you know, handle setting up your shipping information and all this stuff. And it's very, very easy to get going. It only takes a few minutes. And in terms of pricing, it's $24 per month for the commerce plan. And then for transactions, you just pay a small fee to Stripe for credit card purchases, the same way you would in any system where you accept credit cards. And that's it. And it's all integrated. You don't need to go out and get an outside system and put that into your website. It's an all-in-one package with Squarespace. It makes it a very, very simple, the simplest way I've seen to sell products online. So if you are looking to set up a store, you definitely need to check out Squarespace. But whether it's a store or a blog or a website or portfolio, the best way for you to find out how great these tools are is to just try it for yourself. And you can do that free for 14 days. There's no credit card required. Just enter your name and your email address, and in a matter of minutes, you'll be building your website. If you already use a platform like WordPress, you can take that data, you can import it into Squarespace, see how your site looks there, and find out how the Squarespace tools give you everything you need to create an exceptional website. And then when you decide to sign up, and I know you're going to want to, as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts by using our offer code TREK10. And as I mentioned earlier, if you choose the annual plan, you can get a free custom domain registration as well. So you can get yourname.com, yourcompany.com. hook that right up. It's very, very simple to hook up, and you'll be good to go. So support us and support Squarespace by going to squarespace.com, try it free for 14 days, then use offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase. And we really thank Squarespace for their support of The Ready Room and Trek FM.
Evening marks the close of day. Skies of blue begin to gray. Crimson hues are fading in the west. Evening ever brings to me dreams of days that used to be. Memories of those I love the best. When shadows fall and trees.
Following the successful destruction of the Zindi weapon, Archer and the Enterprise crew returned home, just as Picard and his crew did after defeating the Borg in The Best of Both Worlds. But unlike Picard's crew, the heroes of the NX-01 returned to a world that was not entirely happy with what they represented. And today we're going to talk about this episode, Home. And to help us do that, we have with us my co-host from Warp 5, Kate Walsh. Hey, Kate, how is everything in Australia this morning?
Oh, it's not too bad. I've got the day off work to be here with you today, so it's especially good on that front. How are things in Japan?
It's pretty good. It's a pretty nice day here. Now, when you asked your boss for the day off, did you tell him, I need Monday off because I need to record a Star Trek podcast?
I said I need the day off because I need to go home.
Oh, hey, that was nice. Nice touch there. Mm. You literally are going home today with Matthew and me here. All right. Well, let's jump into this episode. And Matthew, you said, oh, it's Enterprise Week. Can I pick the episode? And you immediately said Home. I know you love this episode. And, you know, you talked about, in preparing for the show, you talked about Thomas Wolfe's book, You Can't Go Home Again, and the May Veterans. And I think that's really a great tie into this. Why don't you start us off with the discussion here?
Yeah. This is one of my favorite Enterprise episodes, and I think it's because, like Family, it deals with the repercussions of one of the, you know, the most extensive series of Star Trek episodes. I mean, this is the first time that they had ever done a series long or season long arc series in Australia or England, as they would call them. I was really glad that they didn't just skip over this, because this is something you kind of have to deal with. You know, after something, an ordeal that lasts a year like this for this crew, you know, Archer even mentions in his speech, you know, the 27 people who didn't make it back. You know, you have the 7 million people who died on Earth beforehand, and all of the trauma that they go through. You know, all of the decisions Archer had to make, all of the decisions T'Pol had to make, all the decisions that Trip had to make, all these people were forced to make all these decisions that they weren't happy with. And yet everybody's calling them heroes. And how, what does this feel like? And it did make me think of Thomas Wolfe's book, You Can't Go Home Again, and that whole idea of veterans who would come home from any war that they fought, you know, from all the wars that we have. And we know, as you know, World War II all the way up now, to guys coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan. How do you talk about, can you come home again when you're a completely different person and nobody can really understand what you've been through except the people who have been there? And you come home a really different person. And all of these characters are changed in some way. I think the only one who may be quite the same is Phlox. Mm-hmm. You know, he's probably changed the least out of all of the characters, but even him, you know, coming back to an Earth that he doesn't necessarily recognize. is a big deal. So, you know, this is an episode that I always thought was one of Enterprise's best because it just dealt with the repercussions of everything. And it's a slower episode. It doesn't, you know, and I like when you get to slow down and have really good character development. And as you know, Chris, that's one of my favorite things about any Star Trek series is really diving into characters. And this allows us to like, okay, we got through the simple Cold War thing. We got through the Zindi thing. Now we can just breathe for an episode. And honestly, I think you could have done a few episodes here to kind of deal with some more of these repercussions. But at least they gave us this one to really dive into, you know, who is Archer now? Who's he going to be? You know, what's going to happen with Trip and T'Pol? What's going to happen with Earth? Is it going to be the same, you know? How is all this going to affect everything? And what does this mean then for the Alpha Quadrant now in general? And so this really starts us on that road that Manny Coto and his bag of awesomeness Magic is going to bring us. Exactly.
His bag of awesomeness, yes.
Yeah, he didn't have... at this point, there was no hindsight involved.
Okay, that came later, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it sets up a lot of stuff for the fourth season, although sadly... a lot of the interesting points, like the xenophobia, they don't come back to until the very end of the season because they do so much of the TOS stuff in the middle. But you mentioned that they come back and everyone sees them as heroes. And of course, that's true. It's compounded by the fact that a lot of the ordinary everyday people, maybe they see them as heroes because they saved Earth from being destroyed. But at the same time, they see them as a threat to Earth as well, as explorers going out there and alerting the galaxy to the fact that we're here. And that's where the xenophobia kicks in. So it's even more difficult to come to terms with, you know, they did things, you see with Archer, he did things that he, you know, didn't want to have to do. You especially see it in his conversations with Erica Hernandez here, how jaded he's become about exploration, you know, and did that mean that I had to torture someone and so forth? It's compounded by the fact that then you have people like the scene in the bar where, you know, they see the space exploration as a threat as well.
Yeah, I think that was one of the things that was really interesting is you do have this like clear difference. Like there's people who just worship them as heroes and then there's people who just see them almost as the new bad guys. And which I think is a representation of maybe two different sides you've seen on some larger levels, like, you know, everybody that came home from World War II was considered a hero. Nobody considered them anything but a hero. But the minute you got into Korea or Vietnam, they came home and they were almost the enemy. And so I think they're really playing off those two sides here by giving us this, you know, and especially obviously with this being a whole 9/11 thing with the Zindi being the representation of that. That's how a lot of those guys came home. People either saw them as heroes or they saw them almost as the villain. And there wasn't a lot of room in between that, you know? And so I like that they're playing on this and making us kind of like have to look at ourselves and how do we feel about this, you know? I thought it was interesting, Chris, you know, we talked about in news the season 3 trailer for coming out on Blu-ray.
Right.
And Connor Trenier says in one of the quick clips of the interview they did with him that he said, you know, he was able to deal with 9/11 by going through this season, you know, process what had happened because of the season being involved in it. And in some ways, you know, whether you liked the season or not that came before, when I think back on what it did for me, I feel like in some ways it did allow me to kind of get some of that anger out, you know, that I might have directed wrongly. And be able to think through some things. And now when I rewatch, I think to myself, wow, they really are doing a lot of good stuff. And when you get to home, they're still doing it. And it's one of Star Trek's greatest gifts is to tell us a story, but then make us have to go, oh, wait, they're talking about us now. And I'm not so sure I really like what they're having to say because, man, I have to, you know, kind of reexamine my heart here. And am I falling into the same traps, you know? And so this is one of the reasons I really like this episode because it's really building off, you know, well, what can we say? Kind of a lame end to season 3, you know, when you try and tie all of it together because they were trying to get rid of the Temple Cold War for good and
Yeah.
You know, so.
You know, it's funny. I think of this episode as the premiere of season four, even though it's the third episode of the season.
Exactly.
Because Stormfront for me feels like the end of season three.
Right.
Even though it's the start of season four. So, Kate, what is your take on Home? I know with T'Pol, with Trip, of course, what's going on Earth as well.
Well, you mentioned that we don't really get back to the xenophobia stuff until towards the end of the season. And it is perhaps a little bit of a disappointment to me as well that more of this wasn't explored in the fourth season and the interpersonal repercussions of what had happened with the Zindi arc. As much as I love the TOS stuff, it's these episodes that really stand out to me in the fourth season. And it's also quite interesting to me to follow the dialogue with Archer and Hernandez throughout this episode, because it's Archer's internal struggle about his expectations of their mission going out, perhaps his own naivety, self-loathing around that, coming to terms with the things he then had to do when he was out in the expanse, and what that means for him now coming back. He looks at the way that other people view him, whether it's as a hero or a villain, as we've said, and him trying to come to terms with how he's going to see himself is perhaps the most interesting aspect of this episode. We can observe at the start he's very uncomfortable with being thought of as a hero. But I also think he goes into that briefing early on with the Vulcans to talk about what had happened with the Vulcan ship in Impulse. And he's also caught off guard at the same time by them not putting him up on a pedestal, by the interrogation that he's facing as well. So he seems to be in these two
minds. I don't
know
if it's not putting him up on a pedestal so much as, I mean, I don't think that Archer wanted to be put up on a pedestal.
No.
But I think that he didn't want to be questioned by people who weren't there about a situation that, I think he did the right thing.
Do you guys
agree that he did the right thing in that situation?
What I meant in saying that was more that he was facing these conflicting opinions about himself. You know, on the one hand, he was being labeled a hero. On the other, he was being questioned and judged when he thought that he was doing the right thing.
Okay, yeah.
So,
right.
And that kind of kickstarted his own internal struggle to that next level in what we see when he's up on the mountaintop.
Yeah. You mentioned his naivety, but I think it's not so much Archer's naivety going out. It's humanity's naivety going out, because when he has those conversations with Hernandez on the mountainside, and like when he points out the planet, which will eventually be named Archer 4, and he talks about, you know, she says maybe humans will go back there one day and colonize. And then the conversation goes on. And throughout the conversation, I still get the feeling that Hernandez is still kind of the dreamer and the wide-eyed, I'm going to go out and explore space. Even after everything that's happened, it's almost like she's thinking, well, okay, these aliens came, but all space can't be like that. We can get back to where we thought we were going to be to start with. And Archer knows that the reality is that dream of just going out in ships and exploring space and everything's going to be all wonderful all the time and scientific and exciting just isn't reality. So I think that Archer going out in season one was representing humanity's naivety. And now Archer and his crew are the only ones who really understand what it's like. And that's part of the struggle they have in this episode, is that they know what it's really like out there, and they're still bumping up against people here on Earth, even the captain of the Columbia, who still don't get it yet.
And as in that particular discussion about that M-class planet, as he says to her, yeah, there was a psychotropic compound and we pretty much nearly all killed each other.
Yeah. Within a few hours.
Yeah.
Well, and it brought up this idea, you know, Archer has in this episode is angry, cynical, jaded, all of those things, frustrated. And he, you know, obviously he has PTSD, and so does the entire crew probably. And what I thought was really interesting though is that there has to be a kind of medium between Hernandez and Archer, you know, that there's going to be a third way, you know, and Archer, I think, especially in the rest of season four, is really going to have to find the medium himself, because he's still going to be the only captain out there. And he's going to be the only one with a lot of experience. He's going to be the one that everybody leans on. And he has to figure that out. And you slowly watch him find his equilibrium as the season goes on. But in this episode, you know, you're kind of really struck by that idea of, okay, what is even Starfleet going to be at this point? Or are they going to be more military? Are they going to be more exploration? How do you put that together? And, you know, that's a big question that, you know, even fans have been asking since Star Trek started is what is Starfleet? And Archer's asking those questions because he doesn't have any answers, because right now he's just, I think, so scared. You know, going back though to what you guys were talking about with, you know, Archer and the Vulcans, you know, Archer actually has a really good point when he yells at Saval and says, look, you guys didn't help us at all. This planet would be dust if it wasn't for people like the Andorians who came to our rescue. And I like that he says that. I'm obviously the way that he says it is horrible. And it's not really the best way to get your point across to a Vulcan, because yelling at them just makes them think that they've won. But what he mm-hmm. says is actually really true. And, I liked that played into that kind of xenophobia of this idea that, even the Vulcans and the humans still are not getting along in the way that we think of, you know, later on. And, their relationship is actually kind of a key at the end of what it's going to look like for those two races to really start to bridge that gap. The fact that by the end, you know, Archer and Saval come to this kind of agreement, and this respect that they haven't had before, that Archer hasn't had with him before. I mean, Archer respects obviously T'Pol, but that's because she's earned it. And, you know, in this way, those two coming together, I thought was a great picture of that. And kind of changing that dynamic, because their relationship is much stronger as the series goes on then, of course. And so I thought that was really cool too. This episode is playing on so many different layers, even within the different relationships. And it's kind of retelling the messages that's going all along in different ways. It's good writing. Like, I think this episode just has some great writing. And so,
yeah.
What did you think, Chris, of just the way that Erica kind of moves, you know, Jonathan along? Because she doesn't really preach at him a lot. She just kind of lets him vent until obviously he has the bad dream, and then, you know, helps him kind of, I guess, remember what it is that's worth living for, which is the connection we have as human beings and all that. I don't know. What'd you think of that? Cause I thought that was to me, that's probably one of the most interesting parts of the episode.
Well, I think they could have done a lot more with it to develop it. You know, the scenes are fairly short within the episode, but like I was saying a minute ago, I think that she represents Archer as he was at the beginning of the first season. You know, she still has this idea of going out there, but he needs, you know, she's someone who he needs someone to talk to that is sort of his peer. And so the fact that she's now a captain, I mean, the rank is kind of irrelevant, although within the military structure, she tells him, you know, you're not my superior officer anymore, but he needs someone who is pretty much on the same level as him that he can really talk to, you know, because he can't go and talk to Travis about this in the same way or Malcolm or somebody.
Can you talk to Travis about anything, Chris?
You can, but he might not talk back to you. Depends. They forgot to write his response.
Exactly.
I hear Porthos is a good listener, though.
That's true. Yeah. Excellent listener, as long as you give him cheese.
Right. I think it's important that she's on the same level as him, and also that she has not been out there with him, because it's very important in any situation like this that you're able to get an outside perspective on something. Because if you're both too close to it, this is why he couldn't even really talk to, say, T'Pol or anyone on the crew about this, because they've all been through it together. You do need someone from the outside to give you a different perspective, and someone who can lead you along, you know, through a thought process. And someone who's just comforting. I mean, I think she's comforting to him, and that helps here as well. And the whole all the discussions they have about even having military personnel on the ship, just those conversations themselves allow Archer to kind of mull through his head the position that he is in and rethink everything there.
Yeah.
How about you, Kate, though? I'm curious what you think about this.
Well, I'm not so sure that she really helped him work through the issues. I didn't really, in those scenes...
Not in what we saw on the screen,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I didn't see a change in his perspective. I think, as you say, though, she offered him some comfort. It was quite obvious, you know, and as he spoke about how different they are and how she was Archer from 3 years ago, that they were worlds apart. And she wasn't going to be able to get her head into that space that he might have needed to have someone to work through the issues cognitively. I think that it was maybe that she could be someone just to be there and support him regardless, and that in time he would process those issues on his own. I think that that's more the value that she offered there. And as you say, we didn't actually see him reconcile those issues in this episode. It kind of just moved on from there as the season went on.
Yeah, it's more what she represents and what maybe happened ongoing that we don't see on the screen.
Mm. See, I think what she allows him to do is to give him the starting off point for figuring it out. And allow him to just kind of vent and yell. And I think the scene for me that was the best was when she's challenging him. He's like, what are you going to go do? Go climb at night? It's an awful long way down if you fall, you know. And that he's having to come to terms with that he doesn't want to live as somebody everybody thinks is a hero, because he doesn't see himself as a hero because he knows what he had to do. And having to live with that mantle is too much. But at the same time, I think that he's lived so... What she does for him that I thought was brilliant in the episode is she helps remind him of what was worth living for, what was worth going all that
right.
way for, with fighting for, and worth, you know, maybe dying for, which was we are fighting for the existence of our race, and what that meant was this connection that we have as human beings together. And she gives him that connection again. And I thought that not that the relationship that they kind of create again is a salvation for him, but it's a reminder of, okay, this is why I was there. This is why I was doing this in that.
Right.
So the connection I now have with Erica again is possible because I've saved humanity and giving him some way to start to kind of reconcile. Not that obviously it all happens here, but I thought that that was really beautiful. I just liked to, I thought it was really interesting to have these two people come together and be able to help each other in this way, because he's going to make her in some ways a better captain by letting her know what's out there, you know, and kind of helping break down that naivety.
Well, I think after what he went through with the Zindi, you know, you see he's become very jaded. He's very cynical about things, and it would be easy for him to stay in that place, and it would continue to grow, and he would become nothing like the person he was, and even lose sight of the person that he was and never be able to get back there. But he tells her on the mountainside that all I'm trying to do is get away from you. I look at you, and I see the person I was 3 years ago, the explorer that my father wanted me to be. I lost something out there and I don't know how to get it back, but he wants to get it back. And if you think about the dream he had of the Zindi, if he had woken up to that and she hadn't been there, what would he have done? Would he have gone climb the mountain in the dark? You know, she allows him to see who he was. He might say he's trying to get away from that, but at least he sees who he was. And so he knows that he wants to get back there somehow.
What's interesting, though, is that she couldn't get him to that place by talking to him about it, but they are together
physically.
Well,
not in that short amount of time.
No, yeah. No, but in the short amount of time they're together physically, it seemed to make a massive difference. He switched his head off a bit.
Yeah, I thought that was a little, I don't know, I could have actually done without that part of the scene personally, because it is saying, like, it's almost like it's like Kirk misunderstanding Carol Marcus in The Wrath of Khan when she says, "Let me show you something that will make you feel young as when the world was new." Kirk gives her that look. Except here, apparently Erica really meant that.
Well, yeah. I see that. That's the part where I actually thought that Archer needed that. He needed like he needed to feel again what it meant to be a human being. And
that's a good point.
I mean, that's we can laugh about it and joke about it, but that closeness that, I mean, think about this. And this is one of the things that I even called this section we're talking about, lonely at the top. I mean, Archer's been out there for 3 years now, and he's had nobody to go to. And he's been dealing with all of these situations, himself. And it's a very lonely place to be. And he's just been through probably the hardest thing that, just about any human can be through, having the entire weight of your planet and realizing too, when they learn that it's the galaxy itself is on your shoulders. And if you fail, the galaxy will cease to exist as you know it. So yeah, to have somebody kind of be able to break through and hold you and let you know that you are a human being again in a way that you haven't for 3 years. That's a beautiful, wonderful thing she does for him. And so, we could look at it scenically, just a TV trope or whatever, you have sex and everything's fine. But there's a real depth, I think, to what they're trying to do. And you're right, Chris, you don't get to do enough of it on this show because there's only 42 minutes and the scenes they have together aren't long enough, because you could really have done an entire episode of Archer and Hernandez, pretty much. Mm-hmm. It'd just be him, having to deal with this, and that maybe be enough. But we just don't get that in
that's a good point.
American TV, at least.
Right. Well, let's shift gears and go to something you mentioned a minute ago, which was military or exploration. Because another important part of this episode for me is the series itself is about us going out to deep space for the first time, the Vulcans, the Andorians, humans coming together. We see the Tellarites a little bit in Enterprise, but not very much. But of course, they are the four key founding worlds of the Federation and Starfleet coming together, but figuring out what the mission is going to be in the first place. And Matthew, you and I talked about this quite a bit on Literary Treks when we talked about A Choice of Futures, the new Enterprise book. How do you determine what you're going to be, military or exploration? And at the beginning, Archer goes out there and they really think they're going to be explorers. There's, even the early scenes where he's telling aliens they meet, "Oh, by the way, we're from a planet called Earth." And it's just, we're going to be explorers. But the realization of the Zindi threat that we're going to have a military aspect to what we're doing, it's a big turning point. But then you balance, are we going to just become a military? Obviously, we can't just be explorers. We're going to get ourselves killed if we do that. And we can't, protect the planet here either. So much of this episode does come down to the dialogue between Erica and Archer. But when she asks him about tactical officers, and he says that I would recommend that you choose someone with more military experience, like a Mako. And she says, I don't know if I'm comfortable, having military officers on the bridge. How do you guys feel about Starfleet as a military organization or as a scientific exploratory organization? What we see in this episode, do you think Archer's position is the correct one? Do you think that Erica needs to come somewhere near the middle, and then that's going to be the correct position that we have to move forward with?
I think at least by Picard's time, you are more on Archer's side, because the security chief is definitely somebody who's trained militarily and understands policing, understands military operations. We see that in Deep Space Nine with the war, that you have, Sisko, who is able to move quite easily into military operations and understanding the large scale scope of wartime battle in a three-dimensional space. I mean, so these men and women, really become both. They become, the explorer when they need to be, and the military representation when they need to be. And so you really see that, I think, in the TNG time frame. You don't see it as much in the original series, because the fact that Chekhov is the security chief doesn't really ring true, and even right. in the films at all. And so you don't really see that.
Sulu should have been the security chief.
Exactly.
What can Chekhov
exactly.
do?
Exactly. Talk you to death,
distract you with his hair
or his accent,
don't do that.
I can do that.
But you don't do that. Very, it is against the rules.
Right. you not do that. It is something you see later on, and so I think Archer's idea really comes to fruition later on,
yeah.
and it takes Starfleet a while to get there, but
it's a balance.
It's a balance, definitely. It's never one or the other, and so and you can kind of see that taking form even in the fourth season, is that Archer has to be both. There are times when he's the diplomat in the episode, and there's the time when he just needs to be the guy who's going to kick some ass, especially if he has to go up against Shran in a ice pick battle in an Andorian fight scene.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
I bet they have training on that at the Academy. Andorian fighting 101. How to defend yourself from an ice cleaver.
I think a part of Archer's struggle, though, is that at this point, Mako aren't a part of Starfleet. They are a military organization.
Right.
Whereas when we look at the future, the other series, Worf, whoever is the Starfleet officers, it's not as obvious, it's not as in your face that it's a part military ship. And he does say early on as well that his concern before first going out into space was that how can he be in command of a warship while going out there on a mission of peaceful exploration and making first contact with species? What kind of message does that send? And as I said, at this point, those two functions are very separate, and he can't see it as being them as being compatible. It's got to be one or the other in his mind.
I think in the future, what they end up doing, I said it's a balance. If you look at the 24th century, for example, until the Defiant was built, Starfleet didn't really have warships per se. The Defiant is a warship. Prior to that, not really. Now, the Enterprise E could, I think, be considered more of a warship. The Enterprise D is anything but a warship. However, it can defend itself because it has very, very powerful weapons. And so I think the balance was that you have ships like the Pasteur, for example, or even in the 23rd century, something like the Reliant, had weapons.
Or the Grissom.
The Grissom is a really good example. So something like the Grissom, or in the 24th century Beverly ship, the Pasteur, these are like really scientific vessels. And if they get in a firefight, they're toast, because they're not even designed to defend themselves against anything other than maybe like an Orion pirate ship or something. But then you have something like the Enterprise D, which is clearly designed to be a scientific vessel, an exploratory vessel, and of course, most importantly, as everyone knows who watches TNG, a diplomatic transport ship, which shuttles people from planet to planet so they can have conferences. But
that's where all those staff meetings come from.
Oh, yes. It's also a fantastic place to have staff meetings.
Exactly.
I think on Deck 12, there's actually an office depot where they can go in and get the paper, make copies. Yeah. But the balance, anyway, is that they never really created warships per se, but they equipped a lot of their ships with very, very powerful defense systems so that they could take military action if it's required. And then eventually, when you get the next great threat, like the Zindi threat was here, you get the Borg threat, that's when they decide, well, maybe we need warships. And they build the Defiant.
Well, and at least by the 24th century, too, they'd all gotten this training because Geordi does a fantastic barrel roll. And where else would he have learned that if he hadn't had all that great military training?
That's right.
So does this mean that the key to successfully finding that balance is to actually just dress the ship up a bit more, to put some nice fancy upholstery on and, you know, some nice mood lighting so that it kind of hides all of the weaponry? I mean, in Enterprise, it's all on show. Whereas you've got quite a powerful ship in the Enterprise D, but it just looks like it's a pleasure cruising ship.
It's a big casino in space, is what it looks like.
Space hotel.
A very nice casino, though.
What happens exactly.
It has more tasteful carpeting than your average casino does.
So, you know, we're happy at being a warship. We just don't want to see it.
It is funny. This is a little bit off talk, but you think about that, is that the Enterprise E was made, you know, when they were creating First Contact, they wanted a ship that was less exposed. So they cut out the neck for the ship because, especially in the Enterprise D, it's quite ridiculous. And then the A was the same way. It's very thin and it seems vulnerable. And so Starfleet design, I mean, you know, you think about that. Starfleet's design in Enterprise is actually a very good design because it's very, you know, it has a lot of surface area on top and bottom, but, you know, there isn't a lot else for you to hit. You know, it's a good design. It's sleek. It's maneuverable. And so it's not a bad ship for a firefight. You know, obviously it was interesting too, you know, as Erica and Archer are walking on the Columbia, she's talking about all the upgrades that they've made weapons wise, just because of what Archer's given them, which is pulsed phase cannons. Which is very cool. And, you know, they've upgraded the hull plating and all of those kind of things because of his recommendations. And so they're already doing that at that point. And I thought that was interesting to see. It reminds me of what Teddy Roosevelt said about carrying a big stick, you know. You're not wanting to be friends with people, but at the same time, you're also not going to be bullied by people. And I think that's what Starfleet's mission has always been, is Spock says in Underscored Country, you know, Starfleet's mission has always been one of peace, but at the same time, it's also to keep the peace, to make sure that nobody just comes waltzing through the doors, whether it's the Borg, the Dominion, you know, you name it, as Starfleet's been through those kind of wars. And so.
But to conclude this little discussion about military, I think that Enterprise is important because it shows at this point, going into the fourth season and home here, there's the discussion about who are we going to be, and then they have to find their way. And then, you know, unfortunately on television, we don't really get to explore that. But Christopher L. Bennett is exploring this now in the new series of novels that are a transitional story of the formation called Rise of the Federation. But by the time we get to the 24th century, I think we see a more mature position that Starfleet has with its vessels, and that it has found a way to balance the scientific exploratory side and the military side. And I don't understand the fan debate that goes on, where some people get very upset because they insist that Starfleet is not a military organization at all. And I don't know how you can actually watch Star Trek and come to that conclusion. You know, just because Starfleet engages in battles to defend itself, or as you just said, and as Spock said, keep the peace, doesn't mean that it's a military organization, but also it's not exclusively a scientific organization either. Because if we were attacked today, and apologies to Bruce Willis and the writers of Armageddon. I just don't think that NASA is going to fly up anywhere and destroy the enemy as they're coming towards Earth. So you're not going to be purely a scientific organization either.
Well, I don't think Jeff Goldblum and a Mac virus are going to do it either with Will Smith. So,
well, if the virus puts a skull and crossbones on your screen, though, it might work.
Oh, the dreaded skull and crossbones. It's almost as bad as the beach ball on a Mac.
Really? Tell me about it. Okay, well, let's move on. And Kate, let's get into Trip and T'Pol. You know, this is something that we've talked about at times on Warp 5 and the whole development of their relationship. And this story is really great because it's the point where Trip realizes that he's in love with T'Pol. Mm. And the fact that they go to Vulcan and T'Pol's mother, T'Less, is there, and Trip actually has very good conversations with T'Less about this is important to the development of their relationship.
Yeah, it's a really interesting storyline, this one. It's quite heartbreaking in some ways. I mean, we know that, and we learn quite a bit about Vulcan culture in this episode, just in the short scenes that we have. And
in fact, Kate, this is the first time, I don't know if people realize this, this is the first time we see Vulcan cities in live-action Star Trek. The only time we went to Vulcan really was in the animated series with Spock in that episode yesteryear.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but it's also the first time we see T'Pol in capri pants.
Maybe.
Yeah, she has a very snazzy outfit, as Trip likes to remind her. She is a snazzy dresser.
She's a snazzy dresser.
But what I was saying is that there's this undercurrent in the episode, and it's a struggle that Trip has had all the way through, is stepping outside of his own ethical perspective and appreciating other cultures for what they are. And that comes up again here, but it's a very personal angle as well. It's not just a matter of him looking at T'Pol's situation in wanting to fulfill her family obligations and understanding that that's, you know, in Vulcan, that that's more important perhaps than it's considered on Earth. You know, he has something, quite a personal investment here, in that he realizes the moment that he's lost T'Pol, he realizes that he loves her. And I think it says a lot for Trip's character and his development over the series that in the end he can respect that and still be there for her.
I thought that especially the discussions he has with her mother, and especially at the very end where she is actually encouraging him to go tell T'Pol, because you almost feel like her mother realizes exactly how much this guy loves her and how good he would be for her because of who she's become. You know, she's made comments about how different she is, and that T'Pol's emotions have always been close to the surface, and now they're even more so. And in some way, I think Trip is good for her. They really are good for each other because they balance each other out very well. And that's clear from the moment they get to Vulcan, and she drops her bag and is about to give him a funny dressing down, and then her mother interrupts. But it's done with such, like, love between those two. You can tell these two people really love each other. I just love that Trip says to the mother, he's, no, I can't add more to her plate, and I won't. And the way that he loves her so sacrificially is completely different from the Trip at the beginning of the show. I think it's a really good explanation and just representation of how far he's come as a character. And for me, it was the knowledge that these characters were going to be together somehow. Luckily, we have the novels. Well, I'll mention again. So if you're doing that Literary Treks drinking game, we've mentioned the novels again. So you'll want to take a shot. But I think that, I don't know, I just really love this story. And one of the reasons was because Trip and T'Pol were some of my favorite characters. And the service that they do to both the characters in this episode is really, really well done.
You know, T'Less talks about the importance of family on Vulcan. But I think this plays into that. What she's saying to Trip, and she's telling Trip it's not too late. You know, you can still go tell her. And T'Less says that I may not condone your relationship, but it's important for her to have all the facts. It's I mean, maybe T'Pol marrying Kos benefits the family in the view from the outside, but at the same time, this is T'Les putting the importance of the family, which is her and T'Pol, ahead of things. It's not. T'Les isn't doing it for personal gain for herself, as she mentions earlier that, oh, I understand on Earth that children, you know, put their personal gain and their personal desires ahead of the family. And Tripp says that's pretty much right. T'Les isn't putting anything that's going to benefit her personally on the line here, other than her daughter's happiness. But that's what I'm getting at, is that it is for the benefit of the family here, because she wants her daughter to be happy, and that is good for the family, the two of them.
Well, all the way throughout the episode, T'Pol's mother talks about how different T'Pol is from the average Vulcan with her emotions. The conversation comes up with Tripp about how T'Pol regularly says thank you, that she's a little bit more human perhaps than many other Vulcans. And you get the sense that, yes, she acknowledges that, but she doesn't really accept it, I think, by the end of the episode, partly because of Tripp's sacrifice, but also because of an acceptance of who T'Pol is, and then knowing that Tripp will be good for her because of that. You know, that T'Pol's been willing to sacrifice for her family. Tripp's been willing to sacrifice for his love of T'Pol. And I think her mother finally is willing to accept her daughter for exactly as she is, even with those perceived faults as a Vulcan.
Well, and I really liked, too, that, and I thought that this was really good. You know, this is the first time in history that we know of that a Vulcan and a human have fallen in love and have had relations together and have thought even about having a relationship beyond that, such as a marriage. And so the fact that they would struggle so much in the series, it was hard watching it the first time, especially since we don't get any good resolution to it, especially with that episode that shall not be named. But I liked the fact that this is a struggle, because this is what it would be like when two alien species for the first time in recorded history for that species together are thinking about doing this. It's not easy. It's not cut and dry, especially with somebody like a Vulcan and a human, you know, as human as T'Pol is, she's still very Vulcan. I think as I watched through Enterprise again, the way that they play out this relationship is really smart, and it just makes me sad that Enterprise did not go on, because obviously Tripp would not have died, and they would have played this out better. It's a good storyline, and I loved the interaction between them here. Every time they went back to Vulcan, I was very excited to get back there to see how that story was going to progress, because you knew something big was going to happen in that relationship for those two. And it's just sad we didn't get a better resolution by the end of the series, because they pulled a Joss Whedon and let's just kill a random character for no good reason at the end.
It'll be shocking.
Yeah. It'll just be stupid.
Oh, well, you've heard Brannon, I'm sure, talk about the motivation for that and being linked with what he wasn't able to do on Voyager. Not that that makes things any better for us, but...
Well, if you wanted to kill Harry Kim, I'm fine with that, but Tripp Tucker?
He wanted to kill 7 of 9.
I would have been okay. I guess I would have been okay with that too. Tripp was, I don't know. He's one of my favorite characters. No, Tripp is one of my favorite characters ever in Star Trek. And so that last episode was like a dagger in the heart.
I'm fine with killing any main character on any show if there's a justification for doing it in the story, so that you as a viewer feel the impact and it feels real for you. And killing Tripp was probably the absolute worst execution of killing a main character. You know, killing Jadzia was bad as well, the way it was handled, but at least it somehow tied into the ongoing story, as lame as it was. And of course they had to do it because of her leaving the show. You know, here there was no reason whatsoever to kill Trip. It didn't serve the story.
I think Seven of Nine's death may have been the one death that could have been done really well, following human error, that the idea was that she could never become completely human and therefore was willing to sacrifice herself for the safety of the crew and for getting home. And I think that would have had a fitting place. I don't think in this particular instance that the death of Trip worked, unfortunately.
But maybe they would have done it like they did with Data and Nemesis, and then at the end of the episode they would be in Janeway's ready room and then Four of Nine would be there and
yes,
the Doctor would figure out how to, you know, put Four of Nine in the alcove and transfer all of Seven of Nine's memories into it. And
see, that would have been good stuff right there. Yeah. That's, man, we were just writing good Star Trek right now.
We really are. Before we leave the topic here of what's going on Vulcan, a couple of points about Teles. This sets up, although I'm not sure how intentionally it sets this up, but it sets up the Serenite trilogy later on and what's going on with T'Pol's mother. The fact that Teles is no longer at the Academy. She says she was forced to resign. There's this fabricated case that she stole restricted data from the archives. They're blaming her for what happened at Pajim. But, and then, you know, even Koss is involved later on in the Serenite trilogy as well. But whether it was intentional, I'm not clear. And maybe you guys know, and I've missed something, how far ahead they were thinking in terms of the stories and what was going to go on Vulcan down the road and what was going to happen with Teles. But either way, I think this works really well to foreshadow what's to come and to set up those stories and to position Teles where she is and to put T'Pol in the tough situation that she's in later on as well.
Yeah, it does a really good job to do that, especially when you think about how well it does play into the whole Serenite Kirshara episodes. Mm-hmm. In that by going to Vulcan, you've already primed the pumps for wanting to kind of go back there again and get more information on Vulcan. I mean, this is the first time we've ever had this. I mean, since, what was it, Among Time, this is the first time we've been back to Vulcan like this.
On television, and really,
yeah. And really seeing a Vulcan family and all of those kind of things. And so it's just really well done. And also, too, in some ways, T'Pol is mirroring Archer in this episode. You know, she's going home and realizing that she has a reputation with her people, and it's not necessarily good. You know, mm-hmm. Archer's reputation is one of a hero. T'Pol's is more of somebody that they might consider a little bit of a traitor.
Right. T'Pol doesn't have the giant statue yet because, you know, the Vulcans, they're really statue people.
Right. Yes, they are a statue people. You know, they like their statues. They like to put them next to big volcanoes. T'Pol will probably get her statue someday. But right now, it is very interesting that she has and when she realizes that she has this reputation, it kind of takes her back because I think she sees the welcome that the Enterprise crew got home, especially, you know, the kind of hero worship that they've been given. And I think she in some ways kind of expects that the same way on her own planet. And then to realize that, no, they don't feel this way about her is very interesting. Until the very end, obviously, where you get Archer and Saval talking, and Saval says, you know, T'Pol told me that our entire galaxy would have been overrun, and so we owe you a debt of thanks, not just for saving Earth, but for saving Vulcan and every other planet. And so, you know, and apparently that's not wide knowledge there on Vulcan yet, so... her reputation has suffered a lot, and that's a very interesting thing to see played out in just a different way, and kind of forcing her into this decision that she doesn't want to be making. You're a little angry too at Koss for taking advantage of it. Like, why would you want to be married to this woman who obviously doesn't want to be married to you? You know, even for Vulcan tradition, I mean, it doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So I wish that had been played out better. Because you don't get a lot of answers to that later on, even in the Vulcan trilogy that comes up. You don't really get any answers as to why he's, you know, actually married her and chosen to go through with it, even though he doesn't have to. He could have just walked away. So, mm-hmm.
What do you think they had for their reception? Do you think they had Chinese takeout?
If Flux was catering, probably, yeah.
Yeah, with some nice egg drop soup.
Yum. Mm,
yeah. probably statue cakes.
Statue cakes.
Yeah.
What we call here on Earth, rock cakes.
Exactly. They're a big hit there.
I bet, too, if you go to any kind of resort on Vulcan, I bet they have the giant chocolate statue fountain.
Oh, yes.
Looks like the
yes.
statues, but the chocolate's yeah. running down. You can stick pieces of fruit into exactly. the marshmallows.
Well, you know, at Easter, kids get, you know, chocolate bunnies, you know, but on Vulcan, they just get chocolate statues. So, you know, the big statues with the huge, you know, Vulcan weapons. Kids love yeah. those.
And you travel to Vulcan, you don't pick up a Hawaiian shirt, you pick up a nice pair of capri pants.
All right. Well, we are almost in an hour, but there is one other topic that I want to touch on from this episode, which is the xenophobia that we see on Earth and what we think about that being in the story, how it plays out. I think I'm really glad that's in the story. We did talk briefly about it at the beginning of the discussion here. I think it's really important. I'm glad Enterprise did this because I feel that, especially in the 24th century Star Trek, on the Next Generation, everything seems too easy on Earth. Everything just seems like it magically became a paradise. And I think it's very realistic and it's important here in Enterprise that they show how the humans react to what happened with the Zindi, the backlash. You mentioned earlier, Matthew, that the humans and the Vulcans aren't quite getting along with each other yet. And that's what you would expect. I mean, they've only known each other for about 100 years. You wouldn't expect even two cultures on Earth to be intermingled for 100 years. You know, I mean, we would probably be running fairly smoothly by then, especially these days. But there would still be a lot of problems and a lot of glitches and a lot of cultural clashes going on. And I'm not talking about things, you know, like the Middle East, where they've been trying for thousands of years to get along with each other. I'm just saying, two nations kind of working together on something, which is what's happening here with Earth and Vulcan. But there must be some animosity amongst the general population towards the Vulcans, some fear still as well. And that's surfacing now because of what happened with the Zindi. And this is where Enterprise set up a very, very good storyline, which should have been played out all through season 4. And I would think even if Enterprise had continued, it should have taken some time to resolve itself. And maybe by the 6th, 7th season of the series, humans start to come to terms with the alien presence on Earth. But how do you guys feel about the scenes here that we get with the xenophobia?
They're good. I mean, again, with the whole 9/11 parallels, you know, dealing with the idea that just because you are of a certain ethnicity does not make you basically a terrorist, you know, and treating any alien, I mean, somebody like Phlox, like, who that guy obviously doesn't realize was on Enterprise risking his life to make sure that Earth was safe, you know? And I'm sure that if he had been willing to listen and been like, do you not realize that he saved many lives while we were fighting the Zindi and making sure that Earth wasn't destroyed? Do you realize he was doing that for you, you jerk? You know, I think it goes to show the irrationality of that kind of behavior, and yeah. It is a good message that's needed because, you know, we all need to be slapped in the face every once in a while, and sometimes a TV show can do it in that way where you just get that, you know, it feels like somebody reached out and slapped you in the face while you're watching a show because you might not be thinking that you have that attitude. And you might not, but it is a good challenge for anybody who does.
Yeah. Because talking about the post 9/11 parallels here, this is good with Phlox too, because like you said, this guy doesn't realize that Phlox was on the Enterprise and risking his life to save Earth. And it's the same, you know, post 9/11, there's this reaction in the US that, you know, anyone with dark skin or anyone who's Muslim must be the enemy. And people forget that, you know, in the US military, there are Muslims in the US military who are fighting to defend the United States against that threat. So you can't have that universal reaction to someone.
It's a valid concern to explore, though, in this episode, particularly given that we've also got the debate about whether Starfleet is military or science-based, because that kind of centers around this idea that, as we saw in the first season, that they went out there naively thinking that everyone was going to be peaceful and friendly and we'll just send you the directions to Earth. And you know, and then they got slapped in the face over that and they realized they couldn't make those assumptions. And certainly don't condone the xenophobia, but from a storytelling perspective, it's the flip side of that. It's the individual reactions to that kind of attitude, that can we trust these people? We thought we could, but can we? So I think it's handled brilliantly in this episode, and it does set up those later episodes, Terra Prime and Demons, very, very well. I just think it's a shame, and in many ways, you know, Enterprise struggled all throughout with what direction it was taking, and you can see that a little bit in season four as well. It is very heavy on the original series episodes and the tie-ins there, but there's also these other elements that we could have seen explored in terms of early Federation history and how humanity evolved and started dealing with other races.
Well, and two, I mean, you know, if they had gotten a chance to go on, you know, Terra Prime and Demons would have been a great ending for season four. And then going in and kind of building up to what happens then, too, is the Romulans start breathing down our necks.
Mm-hmm.
And all of those friends that we had leave, you know, like, it's just Earth against the Romulans, the Vulcans, the Andorians, the Tellarites, they all leave. They don't want any part of our war. The xenophobia would have been, I think, or the anger towards people like that would have been even worse, and especially then to the Vulcans. And so you would have gotten to deal with a lot of this stuff as you went on, and that you just don't get to. But having them have to deal with this was, you have to talk about this in some ways, because this is exactly what would happen. And I think they do, like Kate said, they handle this really well, to bring up this issue. And it does play in very well with Demons and Terra Prime. And, it is sad that we don't get more of it.
Well, and like you just said, Matthew, that it would have been great for Star Trek to show to the whole idea of Star Trek and the whole idea of the diversity and the cooperation, to show what might happen to Earth if it did drive everyone away, had to face the Romulans alone, and then came to the realization that, no, we actually do need the Vulcans and the Andorians and the Tellarites and the Denobulans, and that we're stronger when we work together. And if we try to stand alone because of prejudice, it weakens us. And it would have been an opportunity for Enterprise to actually show the development of that principle that's taken for granted in later Star Trek. So it is too bad. All right. Well, we have passed an hour. Really great discussion on Home. I really enjoyed all the topics that we touched on today. And Kate, I'm glad you could join us today. I know it's not always the most convenient time for you to record, but I'm glad your boss let you go home today for this.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So tell everyone where they can find you on the network and such.
Sure. Well, I record with Chris every week on our dedicated Enterprise show, Warp 5. So you can contact me through the Trek FM website, particularly the forums there. I keep an eye on any discussions that might be happening, or through sending us a message or a voicemail.
Excellent. Yeah, at trek.fm/contact or on Twitter at Trek FM. You can send Kate notes through there. All right. Well, thanks again, Kate, for joining us today.
Well, Chris, I think that was a really great discussion of Home. You know, as we talked about there, this is one of my favorite episodes. And the more I watch this episode, the more I realize that they have so much to say. And as we did discuss, this episode has a lot that could have gone on and really spurred on more Enterprise stories and a lot of things that, you know, I would have loved, in fact, to just seen more of Archer and Hernandez's relationship, because obviously they were going to continue this. And that, I think that alone would have been a really interesting thing, because we'd never really seen a captain with a relationship except for Sisko. And it would have been great to see Archer progress in that with Captain Hernandez, at least how that might work. Talk about long distance.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it would have been interesting. It's almost bittersweet watching this episode, because you see how much potential, like you said, how much Enterprise has to say, and then knowing that it's going to end at the end of the season and we're not going to get any more of it is kind of frustrating. I think it's an important note for fans. You know, when the next Star Trek series comes on television, let's make sure we support the series so that we actually get the...
Exactly.
The full depth of the stories they want to tell.
And Chris, I think that's even an important reminder for fans now. Support Star Trek. No matter how it comes out, because if you don't, it's not going to keep coming out. They'll finally just let it die. And you gotta support what's out there. You can let them know nicely what you don't like, but at the same time, if you don't say you like something or go watch it, they're not going to give us more of it, you know? And so the same thing with, as we talked about at the beginning of the show and the news with the Blu-rays for Enterprise and what we hope to get Blu-rays for Deep Space Nine and Voyager. If you want that kind of stuff, you do. You have to go out and buy it. You got to support it, and you got to let them know you like it, and they'll keep doing it. So,
yeah, most definitely. So it was a great discussion. I really enjoy the points that we hit on. But, you know, it's not the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this week. So here are some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, the Orb.
Once. I think Sisko and Dukat, you know, in the best tradition of any kind of good writing, you know, the villain is a mirror, flipped mirror image of the hero, and that, you know, that's for Kirk and Khan and a whole bunch of great Star Trek. So, you know, you get Sisko and Dukat, and they have a lot in common with each other.
Earl Grey.
Jean-Luc Picard.
Because he's larger than life for 90% of the show. He is the captain. Okay, like, I'm going to ruffle some feathers right now. I'm just letting you guys know this is going to be controversial. But he is the captain that Sisko and Janeway wished they were.
The Ready Room.
The Voyager Conspiracy.
Now, Daniel and I were talking about this in a prior podcast about the 80s moment, and so I can see Seven coming up. In this episode, I tried to download too much information in your heads. Try not to study too much in school. Try to divert yourselves. Play with your friends. Go see your family.
Information, too, can be a drug.
Just say no, kids.
To the journey!
Voyager's funniest moments.
They're seeing Sandrines for the first time, and you see that pool shark guy who is such a chauvinist pig jerk, who says something to the effect to B'Elanna, something like, "Treat a lady like a tramp, and a tramp like a lady. It works every time." And she says, "Paris, did you program this guy?" And he's like, "Yeah, why?" She said, "He's a pig, and so are you."
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Carnival.
But they are also dealing with essentially general supernatural metaphysical concepts that are not limited to Christianity. So implying that there's a heaven and a hell in this, I think, is limiting, because the show very clearly states that they are not playing by any simple rule book.
Warp 5.
Archer and the Prime Directive.
In and of itself, that doesn't make it the correct one. I mean, you could argue whether there is even such a thing as an absolute moral position. That is a moral position in itself, to say that we have moral absolutism versus moral relativism, and the Federation adopts a moral relativist position.
Trek News and Views.
Andorians.
I don't think Shatner would have turned around and said, "Make sure one of them's an Andorian."
No, his special effects would have been, "They all have to look like me."
Yeah. There you go. Yeah.
Literary Treks.
Ongoing 25, the Kittimer conflict begins.
And then you get to this starbase where Kirk and his crew are about to embark on their 5-year mission.
They're eventually going to go on this mission.
Right? Yeah.
Eventually.
It'll happen.
One of these days they're going to go.
It does kind of make me wonder if they... if they're stalling because
they're stalling, yes.
Yeah, they're stalling because of the film.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get your daily Trek Talk fix. We have new shows for you every day of the week, and some days we even have two shows for you, and you'll find them in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune. You can download files from the website or stream from the website. Many ways for you to get the shows, so go listen no matter what area of Star Trek you're interested in. We have something there for you. And Matthew, before we tell everyone how to contact us, we'd like to share with you someone who has, and that's an iTunes review that we just got yesterday, in fact, in the US iTunes store. This review is from Fleet Feet 47, so you know they're a Star Trek fan. They've got that 47 right there in the name. And Fleet Feet 47 gave us 5 stars and said, "I will take your podcast to Andoria." What did Fleet Feet have to say about the show?
They said, "I challenge listeners to search for any other podcast out there that brings high-quality productions, genuine Star Trek fandom, and regular episode updates all wrapped up together with the fun of barrel rolls, bosom buddies, and the random Andorian fight scenes. This show blends together a rundown of current Trek events each week, along with the insightful and thought-provoking commentary on the 47 years of great Star Trek adventures. Never a dull moment on this show, regardless of the Trek series, which you might call your favorite. Any Trek fan will quickly put this as one of the top of their podcast directory." What a great review. And honestly, I think they just echoed some of the sentiments that I had put in my review of the Ready Room back in the day. So this is a good review. And mm-hmm. We really do thank you for taking the time to put such a thoughtful review. Obviously somebody who's listened to quite a few episodes of the show.
Right. Yeah. Cause Bosom Buddies hasn't made an appearance in the past few weeks. So, I don't know what they're doing over there at the Susan B. Anthony Hotel, but something's going on, but maybe they'll be back.
Well, I think they're back now.
I think they are. Look at that. It's kind of like the sports people who say on their shows, "We're not going to talk about Johnny Manziel this week." Oh, wait a minute. We just did. So, but I really appreciate the review. And again, yeah, that's what we try to do with the Ready Room is to get all the Star Trek series into this show. So no matter which one's your favorite, there's always something here for you. So thanks a lot for that, Fleet Feet 47. And for everyone else, if you enjoy the show, please go over to iTunes and leave us a review. It actually does help the show move up in the iTunes rankings. It helps other fans find the show. You know, most Star Trek, we have a great listener base. We have a pretty large audience, but it's still a tiny, tiny, less than 1% of the Star Trek fans out there. So most people have never heard of this show, and your review would really help them find out that it exists. So please drop by, leave us a star rating and a written review. We'd love to hear from you. And you can also send us your thoughts about the show through our website at trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room. That'll come to us by email. There's also a tab on the right-hand side of any page that you can use to send us a voicemail if you'd like. And then in social media, you'll find us at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, when you're not, hanging out at the 602 bar, showing off your Starfleet jacket to pick up women, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, when I'm not at the 602, looking great in my Enterprise Starfleet jacket, ordering a nice scotch, trying not to let people know I'm an intergalactic hero, you can find me at Twitter at MattRushing02. Enjoy talking about all sorts of different things there. And then, of course, we do The Orb, where we talk Deep Space Nine all the time every week, and Literary Treks, where we do books and comics. In fact, we had recently just talked about Christopher L. Bennett's brand new Enterprise book, that in-between period of the birth of the Federation after the Romulan War. So some great stuff. If you really enjoyed this, you might enjoy that episode as well. And so those are some of the places to find me. Now, Chris, when you're not arguing with Vulcans about whether or not that they should be appreciated, or whether or not they helped us or not, during our big Zindi fight, where can we find you?
Yeah, I do that a lot. You know, me and Saval, we don't quite see eye to eye on things, but
yeah, you guys go round and round like a record.
Yeah, we really do. Yeah. I mean, you can find me on the network. This is a rare case where I have you and Kate both with me on the same show. So you guys have already covered all the bases on the network. The Orb, Literary Treks with you, Warp 5 with Kate. And besides that, you'll find me on Twitter under username C Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me everywhere in social media under that same username and on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And that's pretty much it, because that's where I am on social media. And those are the shows. But you know, if you follow me, send me an at reply and say hello. And I'd love to chat with you about Star Trek there and anything else you want to talk about. So give me a follow there. Also, Matthew, before we let everyone go, we'd like to ask you again to please support our sponsor for this week's show. Our sponsor for this week is Squarespace, the web's best hosting and CMS that makes it simple for you to create a beautiful blog, website portfolio, an online store, anything else you can imagine. Go try it free today. 14 days, no credit card required. Just enter your name and email address. I know you're going to love it. And when you get ready to sign up again, as a Trek FM listener, you can use our offer code TREK10 to save 10% off your lifetime purchase. And don't forget to choose that annual plan. That gets you a free custom domain registration as well. And another way you can help us, if you'd like to, is to get some aliens from us. If you go to trek.fm/donate, we have 8 aliens that are custom illustrations by Tobu Ushi. He does most of the artwork you see on our website. They're available as badges and as art prints, and you can mix and match, choose which ones you want. We have different levels of contributions you can make, so choose the one that's right for you. Then let us know which aliens you want, and we'll shuttle those right on over to you. And again, those are over at trek.fm/donate, and your donations help us pay for the costs of production, storage, and bandwidth that's needed to bring the Ready Room to you every week, and we really appreciate your support. Well, Matthew, I'm going to go and wander up the side of that mountain and follow those cougar tracks, and hopefully I'm not going to run into Archer and Erica in any kind of compromising situations or anything.
Chris, I think that's a good idea to be careful with that. And Chris, it's a good time to stick a pointy-eared son of a bitch in it, because the Ready Room is done.
Flox's puffy pants. I mean, puffy face.
Yeah, he does have some puffy pants. It was like parachute pants for his face. It's weird.
Oh, you know, we didn't talk about it during the feature, but if that's an involuntary defense mechanism, wouldn't you think that would have happened at some point during the Zindi mission?
Yeah. You know, I would guess so, but...
I thought it was like... It's like some kind of contest. Like we have staring contests on Earth.
Yeah, yeah.
I bet Denobulans have puffy face contests. Who can hold the puffy face the longest?
Oh, that's funny. Well, I can't wait to see that puffy face in HD. I mean, goodness. That's going to be excellent. So
It's going to look... In the trailer for season 4, it's going to go... And Phlox's face is even puffier in high definition.
Oh, goodness.
All right, let me lead us into the news.